mic check, please?
Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Ducks Limit Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Jennings.
I'm your host, Dr. Mike Brazier.
My name is John Gordon. I'll be your host.
And I'm your host, Katie Burke.
Welcome to the Ducks Unlimited Podcast, the only podcast about all things waterfowl. From hunting insights to science-based discussions about ducks, geese, and issues affecting waterfowl and wetlands conservation in North America. The DU Podcast, sponsored by Purina Pro Plan, the official performance dog food of Ducks Unlimited. Purina Pro Plan, always advancing.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Ducks Limit Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Jennings. Joining me today on the DU Podcast is Sean Stahl. Sean is currently with Rich and Tone, but he is joining us in the capacity as a Purina Pro Plan ambassador, and we're going to have some conversations about his field trial slash hunting dog. But before we do that, Sean, welcome to the Ducks Limit Podcast.
Hey, man. Thanks. I appreciate it.
Yeah, man. We're excited to have you here, and you come highly recommended from the Purina folks, for sure. But, you know, I think before we get into, you know, talking about your dog and other things, I kind of want you to introduce yourself to our audience, just kind of who you are, what you do, and even maybe a little brief introduction about, you know, your specific retriever.
I'm the co-host, co-producer for RNTV, which is our TV show for Rich and Tone, and we air on the Sportsman's Channel. And I primarily run most of the goose hunting stuff, some duck hunting, and then John does most of the duck hunting stuff and some goose hunting. We kind of overlap a little bit. I've been with Rich and Tone probably 18 years now, former world goose calling champion, dabbler in the dog games as well. And I have he's a now 11-year-old, we just wrapped up his 11th season. His first season was at 7 months of age, and he's still going strong. He looks just as spry as he ever has, but he's an 11-year-old field champion. His name's Carl with a K. That's his actual registered name, and we call him Carl, and we spell it with a K. He's a field champion. I didn't run him in a bunch of amateurs. Did quite a bit of training with him, but just timing wise with waterfowl shows and hunting season, and just didn't have a lot of time to do that. Probably only ran him on a handful of amateurs. He spent 9 years on a pro truck, qualified for a couple of nationals. He was on the national derby list, also. Been a fun dog. Very accomplished in the field trial games, but he's my hunting buddy. Take him everywhere.
Wow, that's awesome, man. And that's great to hear. He's still going strong at 11. You know, that's pretty old for a hard charging working dog, you know?
It is, when you consider the miles and stuff that, you know, they have on him. I mean, he would literally be on a pro truck for 9 months out of the year running field trials from coast to coast. And then I'd pick him up in September and October. And then we'd hunt from the top of the flyway to the bottom of the flyway and start over. But, you know, I guess it's a testament to just good quality genetics for starters. But, you know, keeping them in good physical condition and having the right, feeding them properly, a proper diet. And he's been on ProPlan, his ProPlan performance his entire life. And it keeps his weight just right, keeps him physically fit. He's still muscular. At 11, he looks like he's probably about 7.
Wow, very, yeah. Very cool. Before we get into, you know, just kind of that conversation of how, you know, you use this field trial dog and then, you know, transition to hunting and what the difference is and how that all works, one thing I wanted to talk to you about was, you know, the same thing that I talked to pretty much every guest I have on here, is how was your hunting season? Because I know, you know, this past season was rough for a lot of people, and I have quite a few contacts up in your area, up around Michigan, and I know that some guys really struggled for ducks, but everything that I heard on the Canada goose side of things was very positive. Is that pretty much how your season shook out up there?
Yeah, in general. I mean, yeah, in general. But, you know, as I traveled across, I think I ended up hunting 8 states and 3 provinces last year. So I got to see quite a bit, you know, around the area. And, You know, I guess it's all relative to how you look at it. You know, any day you get to go out hunting, that's a good day, right? Yeah. You know, I mean, if it, I tell people all the time, it's not the size of the pile that makes the smile. So, you know, if that's what we're after, then, you know, it probably wasn't a very productive season for a lot of people. But, you know, just getting out there, meeting new people and new faces and new places, I call it all the time, getting out on the road, seeing some different stuff, learning some new techniques. And, you know, the weather, for no pun intended, but it kind of stalled out a little bit. And it made things difficult. And I just, more or less, we just kind of picked our spots. And, you know, if it was going to be sunny and 70 and no wind, we didn't go hunting. Because, I mean, it's just not going to be super productive. Wait for a day with some wind, go out. Also, mallards were hard to find. They were still, I mean, there are guys up in Alberta near Christmas shooting limits of mallards still, so which is, you know, highly unusual. But it just, we would target other species. Sometimes we would go, you know, go diver hunting and shoot bluebills. Buffleheads one day or something like that. Just take advantage of the off species, I call them, I guess. You know, everybody out there thinks of mallards is the only duck, but, you know, went wood duck hunting, chase that kind of stuff. So I had a tremendously fun season. This was probably as much fun of a season as I've had in a long time, and made a lot of cool memories. And I think sometimes these seasons that we deem as harder actually are more memorable. We just remember the struggles a little bit more, I guess.
Yeah, that's probably true. You know, if it was that easy and you go out and shoot a limit of mallards every day, you'd get bored with that.
Oh yeah. And you know, as much as people down south were struggling, wondering where the ducks were and, you know, getting upset and claiming this and that, listen, everybody up north was looking for geese too. You know, there was like an initial push of geese, the molt migrants come down and, you know, everything was good and fine and dandy September, early part of October. And then all of a sudden everything that's here was never replaced with anything. It just kind of stalled out, and it was tough. It was tough Canada goose hunting in a lot of places around the country too, for a significant amount of the fall. So it wasn't just exclusive to the ducks only, as far as, you know, what people were struggling with. And that's, like I said, we just kind of pick our days and pick our spots and go out. And that's one that, like up here in Michigan, at least here, we get 107-day goose season. So you can pretty much, between 107 days of goose and 60 days of duck, and the way they're kind of staggered out in the different zones. And then there's a goose management zone here by the house, pretty much from September 1st to February 12th, outside of about a 2-week period split all the way through there, you can hunt waterfowl somewhere around my house, which is pretty darn nice. So you can kind of pick your spots and pick when you go.
Yeah. Were you able to take advantage of that mid-January kind of, you know, Arctic vortex or whatever they were calling, polar vortex, or, you know, that the big weather system that came in, you know, especially, I know it really hit you guys pretty hard up there. Were you able to take advantage of that?
We sure tried. And yeah, we did. We ended up, we had intentions of taking the boat. I got a 20-foot express boat, and we were going to haul it down and got a big blind on it. And you hunt six guys out of it. And we were going to try to do like Nebraska, Kansas, and that polar vortex kind of pushed that way down. We were down in South Oklahoma, North Texas, snooping around, and we had fun. We had a great time. We probably should have hauled our goose rig, but we went primarily after ducks, and we got into them for a couple of pretty good days. And boat hunting, you don't, I mean, it's a little different than field hunting. You spend a lot more time looking, scouting, and then setting up, you know, getting on a hunt. And we had a couple good days where we had, you know, some mixed bags and shot a bunch of boom bills and you know, green winged teal and stuff like that. And to me, that's fun. I grew up in Michigan and we raised ducks, but most of them are wood ducks and mallards and a few teal and stuff. And I don't consider myself a mallard purist in any way. I'm a duck hunter. And if it's buffleheads and golden eyes one day and wood ducks and green wing teal the next, I'm happy.
Awesome. Well, you're in the right place there. I think everyone on the show here from DU, we're certainly not mallard purists by any means. You know, I'm from Indiana, so we shot a handful of mallards growing up, but you know, it was always a mixed bag and everything from ringnecks to, you know, wood ducks. And so, you know, it was just all about hunting and not necessarily about a specific bird ever. So I guess that's just a little bit of a different mentality for sure.
Yeah. It's a decoy. I'll take advantage of it. We got into the ringnecks one day down there in Oklahoma too. That was fun.
That can be a good shoot. That can be fun.
Yeah. Yeah. They come in kamikaze. It's like they don't care.
And then they come back around after you shoot into them the first time. Everybody's trying to reload. Yeah.
Yeah. There's some decoys took a beating on them. Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, let's talk about Carl a little bit here. And, you know, I think one thing for me is someone who's always had a lab, and I'm always say that, you know, I'm a very, very amateur, probably not very good trainer, which reflects in my dogs typically. But you know, how did you kind of get to the point where, you know, when you got the puppy, how were you like, all right, I want him to be in field trials. I want him, you know, to put him on that trailer and let him travel. Is that something that you went into knowing that you wanted to do?
So interestingly enough, the intention of him was just to be a gun dog. I had been in the dog games. I started out running hunt tests, went through that, the natural progression of I'm just competitive by nature. And, you know, the hunt tests and stuff, you're just kind of going against the standard and you get judged against the standard and you get a ribbon, pass, fail. But in field trials, it's, you know, it's win or go home, basically. Mm-hmm. And you get, you know, first, second, third, fourth ribbon. But I had my first dog, Deuce, and we kind of did hunt tests and then jumped into running some qualifyings. And then my next dog was Trace. That's a natural progression, right? Deuce, Trace. he was a well-bred dog. My first dog, Deuce, was kind of backyard buck and Sioux bred together, but it's just one heck of a hunting dog. And just kind of got it and was great at anything you did. And then the next one was, I got him on a NFC chopper in a qualified all-age female and had him and got him the field trial game, you know, and just liked that competitiveness of it. And then as he was getting older, I had a buddy that he had bought it. He was in well into the field trials and he bought a couple of puppies and he had me raise one and he raised another one just because you can spend more time individually if you only have one puppy. And I've raised, you know, puppies for him in the past. And so I raised a puppy for him, one of my best friends. And when he got about 4.5 months of age, the puppy that I raised was Carl. And he had another dog named Frank. And he put them both with a trainer. And the trainer had him for like 2 months, 2.5 months. And Carl had just like a little funny swim. He kind of puppy swam. Like he'd swim along and kick his foot out. Swim along and kick his foot out. And he had to make a decision at 6.5 months of age, you know, which puppy he wanted to put money in. And they chose Frank. And he says, hey, do you want Carl? You can have him. And I was like, yeah, I like him. He's a cool little dog. You know, he just got everything you threw out, you know, every little thing you tried to teach him, he got, and easy around the house. I think he piddled in the house like 2 or 3 times before he was potty trained it, you know, and then you could just leave him in the house at 4 months of age and go to town and come back and he didn't chew on anything, then go to the bathroom, you know. And so anyway, I got him back at 6.5, 7 months of age and I started monkeying with him, you know, playing around with him. And I was talking to another trainer buddy of mine. And I said, hey, you know, I might want to, you know, finish his basics, you know, send him out over the winter and get his basics done, get him force fetch, calico, all that stuff, and then get him back. But I want to hunt him this first season, you know, as he was 7 months old when I got him. And so we did that. And I sent him down there. He went down there in January, just about his first birthday, to go through, you know, the yard basics and transition. And about 3 months later, he called and said, hey, we might want to try to go a little further with this dog. He seems like he's got something. And he was showing promise. He could mark and, you know, catch on to the things. And next thing you know, I pick him up and October, and he's got 14 Derby points, and he's 21 months of age.
Wow.
So, and anybody that runs that knows what Derbies are, 21 months of age is when they're just starting to get good.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he'd already had 14 months of age, you know, or 14 Derby points at 21 months. I pick him up. Everybody's looking at me like I got three eyes, and I'm taking the field trial dog home to go take him hunting. So, but that's what he was for, you know? So I got him, took him hunting, and then back in January, sent him back south, and that spring he got qualified all age. And then by that fall he had, you know, I think he jammed a couple of opens or something that by that fall. So, and then from there on out, it was, you know, go, go, go.
Stay tuned to the Ducks Unlimited podcast, sponsored by Purina Pro Plan, after these messages.
Now, for some of our audience that doesn't really, you know, follow field trials that much, kind of explain the Derby points and how those are accumulated and how that kind of adds up.
Yeah, so Derby points is, Derbies are for dogs 2 years of age and under. And it's basically up to four series of either land or land water combos, and they throw doubles at them. And most of those guns are standout guns; they're not retired, which they start doing in the all age stakes. So they do that, and then it's 5 points for a win, and then it goes down points wise: 3, 2, 1. Mm-hmm. To fourth place. So 5 points for a win, and he had, like I said, he ran 11 derbies and had 14 points, so he's a little over a point a derby average.
Wow.
And 10 points you get put on the National Derby list, and nowadays they didn't when he ran Derby. Now they have the National Derby Championship, which they've had now for, I don't know, 5 years now, maybe. They've been doing that, and actually Carl sired a National Derby champion.
Oh,
so yeah, I think it was the 22 National Derby champion, I think he sired.
Now, and what's the you know, why would, and this is just kind of for our general audience, you know, why would people look at you weird that you're picking this dog up and taking it for hunting season?
Well, it's kind of a misnomer in both sides of the aisle. Field trial people say you can't hunt a field trial dog because it will teach them all kinds of bad habits. The other side of the aisle says you can't make a field trial dog out of a hunting dog. So that's why they kind of look at you funny. But mm-hmm. I mean, in reality, these dogs are just doing what they love to do. And they're doing it 12 months out of the year. A dog like Carl, you know, he gets put on a truck. He gets to run field trials. He gets live flyers all off season. And then, you know, he gets put back in the hunt world and goes. And there is a difference, and not every dog is capable of handling it as well as I think he does. He's pretty level headed. He knows the game on both sides. He's not a maniac, a lunatic. And that's a misnomer with field trial dogs. Is people, they see dogs like at a hunt test, and they see this dog kicking dirt and snot coming out of its nose and just wild Indian. And they, you know, that dog got to run a field trial. That dog got to be running field trials. Well, any dog can sign up to run a field trial, but the ones that do good are the ones that sit there and watch the birds and pay attention. They don't make a noise. They take off and go. Because in an all-age open stake, in the four series on the water, they'll throw up to a quad, and it may be a 30-minute test where it takes the dog 30 minutes to go out and get four birds. I mean, he may have to do a 400-yard swim to one bird to get it, you know. And obviously some are longer, some are shorter and whatnot, and different concepts. But yeah, you cannot have a lunatic dog be successful in field trials these days. So
do you think that misconception of, you know, field trial versus hunting dog, do you think that's changed over the years, or do you think that it's always kind of been there? Do you think maybe that's getting better as far as people are a little more accustomed to it these days?
I think it's always been there. I think more and more people are starting to do more hunting with their field trial dogs because there's a lot more successful amateurs out there. You're not just putting them on pro trucks and leaving them there 12 months out of the year. They're actually, these dogs are actually living at home with them and travel with them and do hunt, you know, quite a bit. It's, you know, hunting per se erodes control. So all the training and everything and all the tools you put in them, if you're just out there hunting every day and shooting birds, you erode some of that control and they start getting a little wild. Even Carl on occasion will need a friendly reminder. And I always try to mix in training during hunting season. You know, I don't just get them off the truck from running field trials and then hunt them all fall and, you know, and think some of the pieces aren't going to fall apart a little bit. So, you know, if we go out and hunt and, you know, we shoot, you know, 8-10 man limit of birds, I want to try to go with that setup, them decoys out there, I'll go run some long blinds, you know, through the decoys, through all that scent, all the birds that have fallen down there, just to put some of that control back in. I'll maybe go back to wherever we're staying, do some wagon wheels, some ladder drills, some lining drills, maybe have somebody throw a poison bird and run a blind off the backside of it. Something to just get their head back in focused and that we're a team and it's not just a free for all kind of deal.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, what are some of the most common bad habits that they would pick up? You know, is it steadiness? Is it marking? Is it, you know, what is it during hunting season that really sticks out to you that, you know, dogs have an issue with when they come back to the trial?
Yeah, and this goes for any dog. Like I said, hunting erodes control, and most of it comes back to being steady and just sitting there and paying attention and watching the birds and working as a team. You know, they go hunting and they see a bunch of birds fall and they just get that glazed look, just same thing we do. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, we pull up on a big flock of, you know, we start flock shooting instead of picking a bird out. You know, they get the same glazed look on there, you know, and they get out of control and just taking off into the wind and start creeping, start breaking. Some dogs get noisy, stuff like that. That's just, those are common problems that if, you know, if you just take an extra 15, 20 minutes after a hunt, run a couple blinds, go back, try to do some teamwork type stuff, some wagon wheels, ladder drills, stuff like that, just to, you know, kind of get refreshed there in your mind. That, hey, you know, we're still a team here. It's not a solo shot here.
Now, is that difficult, you know, putting him on the truck and sending him? Now, obviously, you're not the one going with him and doing these field trials. Is that difficult for you to do that after the season?
It is difficult because, I mean, it just, for me, it's difficult because I have a pretty strong bond with my, mm-hmm. with all my dogs. Now, I put a lot of road miles on in a year, and they're right there with me. If they're not a co-pilot, they're in the, you know, they're in the kennel in the back. But, you know, it's just part of my everyday routine. We're buddies. And so that's difficult, you know, putting them on that truck in, you know, the end of January. And yeah, I'll see you in 9 months kind of deal. That's tough. And yeah.
Yeah, my wife would be like, no, you're not doing that.
But, you know what, given the fact, like, I justify it to myself that I'm giving him his best life.
Oh, absolutely. He probably loves it.
They honestly, you know, people think labs love the one they're with. They really do. You know, we think they're just so attached to us, and it doesn't take them long to get into a routine and figure out where they're at and like what they do. Now, not all dogs do like going to a trainer, but most of them, like, if it's a good trainer in a good situation in a good scenario, and they get worked all the time, they excel at it. They thrive in that environment. And, you know, he really does. Like, I, you know, it's funny. I'd pull up and he'd kind of look at me like, you know, and just go on doing his own business when he's been to trainer for 9 months. And then about 5 minutes later, figure out who I was. And then, you know, oh, okay. All right. Okay. I guess it's hunting season. All right. We'll jump back. All right. Well, let's go to Canada.
That's right. Yeah. I guess it's duck season. We're heading north.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. That's awesome. So how did you go about picking, you know, the trainer and the field trialer? Like, how is that someone you knew, or was that something that you kind of researched?
No, it's somebody I knew in the circles that we all kind of ran in. And, yeah, so.
No, that's awesome. Who is it that does your field trial?
Well, I don't have anybody anymore because he's
not doing it. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. So what's the next step here from, you know, you go from field trial to duck season. What's basically in between there as far as, you know, anything that you work on when he's specifically with you?
Oh, you're talking about the dog?
Yeah.
When he's here with me, it's now at 11 years of age, you're not really teaching a dog. Once a dog gets through the, you know, basics and transition, starts doing, you know, the field work, that kind of stuff. When he's through, you know, 2 to 4 years of age, you've pretty much showed him most everything, most every scenario and everything they need to know. And you've put all the tools in them to be able to handle any situation that would come up. Basically from then on, that point on in their life is just about maintaining that level. Mm-hmm. Maintaining their conditioning, maintaining their, you know, their mind, make sure their mind's in a good place. Cause you know, sometimes if you take a dog and you run blinds all the time, blinds, they get a little bit, like they just don't care to do it.
Yeah. They get bored.
You know, you got to mix in some flyers, mix in some live birds, some happy stuff, bring their, you know, their, but that's pretty much once they go through that initial stage of training, it's more just getting out in different areas, you know, different terrain, different cover, and keeping their conditioning up, and then the teamwork aspect of it, so they don't lose that and try to go rogue on you.
Yeah. What is one thing that you would tell someone who is like, this is what I want to do. I want to get a retriever. I want it to be in field trials, but I also want it to hunt. What would you tell that person right off the bat?
I tell them good luck. That's a lot of work. I think, hey man, everybody should try it.
Mm-hmm.
The field trial game, even if it's not field trials, it's just hunt tests. It's a good thing to do because it gives you something to do in the off season. It gives you and your retriever bonding time 365 days out of the year. So, you know, whatever it is, if you want to get into field trials, you know, try to get into a club, join a club, go watch field trials, see what they're all about. See if that's something that you want to get into, because they do require a lot of time and money, which a lot of us don't have a lot of either one at times. But, you know, check it out. Try to get in a training group and try to better, better your skills as a handler and a dog. And, you know, like I used to do the calling contest circuit and used to run around, and my primary focus for that was, it was something to do outside of the 60-day duck season or the whatever the goose season was. It was something to immerse yourself into the sport, something you love doing, and you kept your skills sharp. And that's the same thing with the dog games. You know, it's the same concept with it. You know, just it's total immersion 365 days of the year. And anything you do is going to help you and your dog be a better team.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I think, you know, before we get you out of here, I just got one more question for you. I'll give you the opportunity to kind of give us a little preview for RNTV. I know you guys will probably be kicking that off fairly soon, a new season. Kind of give us a little preview and what time frame people should be looking for that.
So we air, just like most of the waterfowl-related content out there on TV, we air the third and fourth quarter, which mm-hmm. basically is the last. You might as well figure July 1st to December 31st when we'll start yep. airing. 13 original episodes, and John Stevens and I kind of split those up. So you'll see me goose hunting, like from Canada all the way down to Oklahoma. I'll be duck hunting from, you know, Ontario down to North Texas area, in my express boat. So, and then John, you know, you'll see him chasing mallards, greenheads, and speckled bellies, and then interspersing some history type stuff in there. John does a lot of, he likes to focus on history a lot, which is awesome, because mm-hmm. As anything, you don't know where you're going if you don't know where you come from. So I think, you know, as much as the sport advances, we still got to know where our roots are.
Yeah, that's right. And what channel are you guys on?
We are on the Sportsman's Channel.
That's right.
Yeah, you can also catch us on MOTV too. That's their digital platform.
Okay, awesome. So at 11 years old, again, I said last question, but something else popped into my head. At 11 years old, once the duck season gets over, what's Carl doing right now?
Right now, he's outside my office wanting in here, but if I start talking, then he wants to be petted. So he's out there, but he's just kind of hanging out, and we are doing stuff as weather permits. Today, we're finally getting some snow, and hopefully this stuff kind of goes all the way across the Canadian Prairie and dumps a couple feet of snow on it. But so we try to get out, run a few marks. I'll do some standalones with a four-wheeler. I've got about 6.5 acres here, so I can do, you know, 250-yard marks with them. I'll just sit them down. I'll drive the four-wheeler out. I'll throw a mark. He'll run and get it. And then I'll sit him down, drive to another spot, and then do that just for exercise and, you know, keep his marking sharp. And then I'll run a few blinds here and there.
That's awesome. At 11, that's very impressive.
You know, it is, like, and that stuff can, I was talking to Gunzer about that. We might not get another hunting season. And I looked at this one as this, you know, at 11, I was blessed to have the last probably two or three actually, based on my last few dogs. But so everyone's, you know, every hunt, every season's a bonus. So and good Lord willing, I think we'll get another one out of them.
Awesome. Yeah, I hope so. That'd be fantastic. I know just from my experience, you know, my lab that I have now, she's getting ready to be 14. She hadn't hunted since she was 10, but really that's because of injury. And so, you know, hearing about Carl at 11, you know, still just getting after it, that's awesome. She just couldn't stay healthy. You know, it was one of those deals where she had, you know, a foot issue, and then she, you know, like you mentioned, sounds like Carl's genetics really, you know, carried him along, and that's pretty impressive.
This right here, we had a February goose season here, and it doesn't happen. Like, I probably one time in the last 15 years where the ice has been off in February here. It's normally guys are ice fishing, but yeah, we were water hunting one day, and me and another guy, and we shot our 10 birds. It's 5-bird limit, shot our 10 birds, come home, and I had to run in the house, and he was watching. Carl's got a bumper that he just leaves in the yard, and he'll grab it and he'll run around and throw it in the air and play. It's just his form of exercise if we're not training. And, I come out, and he's like, my buddy says, hey, he's got blood on his leg. I was like, what? Like, look. I looked down, and right above his right rear foot, he had about 1.5-inch gash. Mm. And it was right down, kind of like how you'd skin a rabbit kind of deal.
Yeah,
he cut it when we were out hunting. Yeah, 5 stitches later, I had to call the vet. 5 stitches later, $400.
And Yeah.
But, you know, but luckily it didn't get any tendons. It didn't cut any meat. It just cut the hide is all it did.
Yeah. You know, and that's pretty lucky, because that's a very delicate area right there, especially for, you know, a hard charging lab like that. And, you know, you're lucky.
It sure is. And like, I didn't ever know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm colorblind, so I don't see that red. And, you know, I mean, it just blended right into me. I'd just never known until, like, we didn't know when we were hunting.
Yeah.
It happened when we got home, and he sure didn't act any, you know, worse for the wear. But that's why, you know, like, I carry, I got one of them gun dog first aid kits.
Yep.
And I carry one in my truck, one in my boat, and one in my trailer, because invariably when that stuff happens, it's on a Sunday and you're 3 hours from a vet.
Yep.
So, you know, I carry that with me. It's got everything in there you need. And I'll usually have my vet, you know, first thing before season starts, write me a prescription for antibiotics, so that if something happens, you know, they get something shoved, stick in their foot or something like that, and it swells up, blows up, and blows out, and you can throw them antibiotics and patch them up enough, at least get you a couple of days so you can get, you know, back to a vet kind of deal.
Yeah, no, that's a great idea for everyone. All of our listeners here, you know, take note of that, especially with you traveling around, going out of the country, long ways away from your home vet. It's a good idea to have multiple, you know, gun dog first aid kits handy. And, you know, there's lots of different resources to find, you know, kits that you can put together. We have some on ducks.org if you want to check that out. But yeah, that's always a good thing to have.
It comes in handy for dogs or people.
Yeah, that's right.
It's just a good thing to have, you know.
Absolutely. Well, Sean, this has been great. I think super interesting to hear about Carl and his accomplishments, you know, over the years. I'm sure I could only imagine, you know, how many ducks and geese he's probably retrieved. Some people keep track of that. I don't know if you do, but I'm sure it's a very, very impressive number, you know, spending time with you guys. But no, I think it's very cool, and I appreciate you sharing the story.
Yeah, man, I appreciate you having me on.
Awesome. Well, we're going to have to get you back on here, maybe here in a month or two, and we'll get you back on the podcast, and we'll do some Canada goose calling tips, and maybe have you bust a call out here. We'll do some different clucks and groans and moans, and you know, really kind of walk through, you know, really having you as a resource for, you know, Canada goose calling.
Yeah, man, anytime. I'd love to do it.
Awesome. I'd like to thank my guest, Sean Stahl with Rich and Tone, for coming on and really speaking to, you know, the capabilities of Purina Pro Plan as a Purina Pro Plan ambassador, and his dog, Carl, successful in field trials and in the duck blind. I'd like to thank our producer, Chris Isaac, for putting the show together and getting it out to you. And I'd like to thank you, the listener, for joining us on the DU podcast and supporting wetlands conservation.
Thank you for listening to the DU Podcast, sponsored by Purina Pro Plan, the official performance dog food of Ducks Unlimited. Purina Pro Plan, always advancing. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the show, and visit ducks.org/DU Podcast. Opinions expressed by guests do not necessarily reflect those of Ducks Unlimited. Until next time, stay tuned to the Ducks. Stay tuned.